we haven't introduced anybody. Justin.
That's okay. I'm Justin. Cena. You know, everybody knows this. But William. We're here to talk to you. We brought you here.
Yeah.
And you've been writing about this since what you were saying, 2016. Can you tell us about? Because we invited you, Cena invited you, and I'm lucky enough to also have been invited because we were both raving about your. I mean, yeah, raving is a good thing, right? Yeah. We're both raving about your art, your two articles, Salafis Throwing Bombs, How American and British Planners Partnered with Al-Qaeda Affiliated Groups at the Start of the Syrian Civil War. And now the new one, Creative Chaos, How U.S. Government Planners Sparked the Anti-Government Protests of the So-Called Arab Spring in Syria. And you know, your bio is like on the Libertarian Institute. It's you've got a B.A. in German Literature and an M.A. in Theological Studies. So, like, what's going on? How do you get from that bio to writing some of the most, you know, encyclopedically researched materials on Syria that you can find on the web here?
Well, I've been following Middle East stuff closely since probably 2003. So in university, I was studying German literature. But I lived in Germany for a while, and there are a lot of Turks there. So I met a lot of people from Turkey, and they were, of course, Muslim. And so I got really interested in Islam. And so while I was at university, I just on the side started taking Arabic classes and started, taking history classes about the Middle East and about Islam. And I kind of had the idea, oh, it would be great to learn to read the Quran in Arabic, you know, not realizing it's kind of impossible. But started learning Arabic, and then I started looking into study abroad programs, and I came across information about a study abroad for Arabic at Bir Zeit University in the West Bank in Palestine. And so in spring of 2003, I went to Bir Zeit for a semester, and that was a pretty kind of a crazy time because the second Intifada was still going pretty strong. That group called ISM was pretty active at that time, if you remember.
Justin was part of it.
Oh, we'll have to talk about that more. That was a time when I was there. That was a time when Rachel Corrie, probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with
her.
That
was a year before, yeah.
She was killed by the Israeli bulldozer in Gaza roughly at that time. And
you were there in 2003.
Yeah, I was in the West Bank when she was killed in Gaza. So anyways, I got kind of introduced to the evils of Zionism at that time, of course, seeing the occupation firsthand and seeing the kind of crazy shit the Israeli army is doing to Palestinians all the time. And then, of course, the U.S. invaded Iraq at that time, and I figured, well, if the Israeli occupation of Palestine is this fucked up, then I guess the similar things are going to be going on in Iraq, and U.S. soldiers are going to be doing similar things to Iraqis, which of course turned out to be the case. So I ended up after Bir Zeit, that's right when I graduated from undergrad, and then I went to grad school. I had an interest in liberation theology, is what I wanted to study in grad school, but after being in Palestine, I just kind of became obsessed with the Palestinian issue. And and then, of course, Iraq as well because of the war. So in grad school, I ended up studying more like about religion and politics. So how like Islam and politics intertwined. I wrote a lot of papers about the Palestinian conflict and about the Iraq war. And then in right when I graduated, I finished grad school, I went to Iraq. So that was 2005, in the summer of 2005, and worked for a little human rights group there. So I lived in Baghdad for about 4 months in 2005 in the summer, and that was right when the sectarian war was really breaking out.
Who are you, man? Who are you?
Sorry to surprise you.
What do you mean you worked for a human rights organization?
Yeah, wait, so did you, Justin, ISM.
Well, you know, it was similar. There's a group. It was a group called Christian Peacemaker Teams.
Oh,
of course.
So they had a project.
Justin, you two are cousins.
Why didn't you just say so?
No one usually knows who they are, but they did some nice work, shedding light on the torture in the U.S. prisons, like in Abu Ghraib. By the time I got there in 2005, it was more like the Iraqi police, Ministry of Interior, the Badr Brigades were going crazy, torturing Sunnis, using drills to torture people to death, power drills. And obviously the Al-Qaeda guys were setting off, you know, bombs in all these neighborhoods in Baghdad and killing these poor Shiites that just were lining up for a job in the police because there's no way to make money. So that was kind of a crazy time. There was a friend of mine and a colleague at the time, Tom Fox, if you've heard his name. He and a few others from Christian Peacemaker teams were kidnapped just shortly after I left in the Ghazaliya neighborhood in Baghdad, and they were all captive for, I think, 7 or 8 months, and finally Tom was murdered. Anyways, I was in Baghdad for that summer for about 4 months, and then I came back just before that group was kidnapped. And then I went back to Iraq with Christian Peacemakers teams, but this time in late 2006, and they didn't have a project in Baghdad anymore. It was just too dangerous, but they had a project in the north in Kurdistan, in Sulaymaniyah. So I was there for about another 3 months, and then I'll mention this briefly, but we ended up getting invited to the Sinjar region, which is much more famous now, obviously, because of ISIS. But in January 2007, myself and a colleague, we and our poor Kurdish translator, we actually got kidnapped in Sinjar. But it was very brief. I was only kidnapped for about 10 days and managed to get released. But and then after that, I just kind of came back home and got a regular shitty job, but kept following Middle East stuff. And so when things broke out in Syria, politics were more anarchist. I was a big Chomsky fan and just kind of figured, oh, governments are all evil and protesters are always good, and just didn't know much about Syria itself. So I wasn't able to really see through the propaganda. And it took me until 2015 before I started to really understand what was happening. And so the first article I wrote was in 2016 when the Syrian army liberated Aleppo. So I just wrote an article about how that was really a liberation by the Syrian army rather than Aleppo falling, and that the army was really liberating it from Al-Qaeda rather than from, you know, a bunch of freedom fighters fighting for democracy, et cetera. So
did you know that that was going to kind of blow up in your face, or did it blow up in your face? Like, Did you lose friends over that, or
overriding that article, or
Yeah. I mean, I just found, like, you know, given your background, because it's very similar to my own, I found that Syria was like where all the kind of anti-war assumptions that I assumed everybody shared turned out they didn't. And so it was sort of like this moment of like looking at all these, you know, pro-Palestine people or people who oppose the war in Iraq and thinking like, wait a minute, you don't oppose the war in Syria because Assad is a dictator? I thought Saddam was a dictator. We opposed that war. And this is what, you know, isn't this what Israel wants? Like, how is dismantling Syria not part of Israel's agenda? I was just totally thrown. And so I wondered if you, I mean, they did really go after people who took that kind of anti-war, consistent anti-war position on Syria, and were particularly kind of angry at them. I wondered whether you had that experience.
Well, from the writing, I mean, I don't think enough people saw any of my articles early on.
That's our one thing that saves us. Yes.
I was going to say this, actually. Your articles are long enough to keep away the idiots, because, like, idiots can't read. Like, you can't, that's why idiots go after normies who dare to break the taboo on certain issues, right? Like, I mean, we're going to get into this, but like think about the fact that, like, Cy Hirsch basically, like, was silenced after Syria, after his, like, wasn't towing the line on Syria. This guy spent decades challenging the U.S. empire, and the thing that got him kind of silenced or, like, lost all his friends in the liberal press was him questioning the narrative on Syria. I mean, so that's the kind of ideological force that's pushed on this. But I think maybe we should sort of, like, start the conversation, because we're kind of, like, dancing around it, because partly is, like, how do we get into your article? How do we approach it? I think a kind of show like this is one of the, I think, the fun, like, the fun is not a word because it's traumatizing to read this stuff, but that like the point of the show is like Sina Ramani's learning journey, like if we can call it that, that like all these people have come along the way and like spent all their time sharing their research, and I've kind of like, wow, there's all this stuff I don't know. And I think this piece, for a long time, you know, I had sort of heard various sort of versions of this argument, but I had never seen it. I've never seen it so well organized and kind of annotated and narrativized the way you have in this story. So, but maybe at the outset, for people who haven't read it, maybe you can kind of narrate the basic thesis of these two, of kind of the general thrust of the first piece, the Salafists throwing bombs. And we can get into the second half of it, because I think they are kind of sister pieces, but how they relate, I think you have to understand the first piece before you can understand the second, I think. But maybe you can kind of take some time. I'm going to mute myself, and you can kind of narrate for us the traditional understanding of what started in 2011 in Syria and the supposedly harsh government response that triggered a civil war, which is the kind of traditional narrative, and which later in brought in these radical actors. Or then if that's not the incorrect, which as your article shows, what happened? Like, what's the sort of general, what's the general line for, you know, for us to who haven't done the research the way you have?
Yeah, so I guess as a lot of people probably know, that the mainstream or the usual narrative is that not only in Syria but in the Middle East broadly in 2011, these grassroots protests, pro-democracy protests erupted. And in the case of Syria, rather than toppling the president, Bashar al-Assad, like President Mubarak in Egypt was toppled, and unlike those countries, the protesters in Syria were not able to topple the government. And instead, the government basically used, you know, crazy violence to suppress these peaceful protests and try to remain in power. You know, the peaceful protesters had no choice but to eventually pick up arms to defend themselves. And so these peaceful protests for democracy transformed into an armed struggle also for democracy, secular democracy, and that over time, eventually these the armed struggle against the Syrian government got Islamized or radicalized, including by the Syrian government itself, supposedly. Bashar al-Assad let all these jihadists out of Saydnaya prison because he knew that they could corrupt the pristine revolution for democracy, and that the Syrian government could defeat its enemies because it would, you know, corrupt this this revolution, and it could get the Western powers to help it in fighting against terrorism, you know? So that's the normal, hopefully I articulated that, the mainstream narrative okay there. But, you know, instead, actually what happened is, instead of it being just a grassroots democratic protest movement that was peaceful to begin with, instead, U.S. planners had been trying to orchestrate anti-government protests in Syria for years. The planning for that started with the neocons in the Bush administration, people centered around Vice President Dick Cheney's office, people like Elliot Abrams, Richard Perle, all the architects of the 2003 Iraq War. Just like they wanted to destroy Iraq and divide it up and have it be a weak country and bring the Ba'athist government down, they wanted to do the same thing for Syria. We can talk about the reasons, I guess. But basically what they did is they had two basic ways in which they were going to try to destroy Syria. The first was to train all these pro-democracy activists in nonviolence and make them citizen journalists and teach them about propaganda, how to organize demonstrations, how to make videos, how to use privacy software like Tor to use new emerging social media technologies like Facebook and YouTube to cause some initial unrest. And that was the first pillar of their strategy. And the second pillar was to, at the same time, mobilize jihadist groups, specifically Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants from Lebanon, Iraq, Libya, Britain, and basically flood Syria with these jihadist militants that could infiltrate the protests and under the cover of the protests, attack the Syrian army, attack the Syrian police. And that way, when the Syrian security forces and army would respond to these terrorist attacks and from these Al-Qaeda militants, these citizen journalists or cyber dissidents could use these social media tools and have all these videos published on Al Jazeera, CNN, et cetera, to portray what the Syrian government was doing, not as an effort to protect the country from these terrorist groups, but rather to, you know, suppress peaceful protest. And so they just tried to ignore or hide the fact that these Al-Qaeda militants were even present at all, let alone attacking the government security forces. And so when all these soldiers were dying, of course, Syrians could watch the funerals on state TV of all these soldiers that were being killed. But then these pro-US or US-funded activists could just come out and say, well, you know, it's the army is killing their own, you know, comrades. You know, these are soldiers that were going to defect and they refused to fire on protesters. And so the army is killing their own soldiers and just, you know, all these crazy conspiracy theories. But that's kind of how it went down. So the point of my articles, one focuses on these, how the U.S. engineered the protests themselves, and the other focuses on how they mobilized these jihadist groups from the different places. And the article just focuses on how that all happened. So it's, I guess the bottom line is, it wasn't the Syrian government that first, quote unquote, pulled the trigger and tried to suppress these demonstrations. This was a U.S. Orchestrated or U.S. and British orchestrated operation from the very beginning that had its roots that go way back before 2011, you know, into the years 2005, 2006, 2007. And that's what I, you know, try to lay out in the article.
You found a memo from 1986 that I hadn't seen quoted from before, which is like almost describes the 2011 scenario, where they say, we believe that a renewal of communal violence between Alawis and Sunnis could inspire Sunnis in the military to turn against the regime. Disgruntlement over price hikes, altercations between citizens and security forces, or anger at privileges accorded to Alawis at the expense of Sunnis could foster small-scale protests, excessive government force, and quelling such disturbances might be seen by Sunnis as a government evidence of a government vendetta against all Sunnis, precipitating even larger protests. I'm just amazed, William, at how close to, like, it's like a playbook almost. The way they describe it, it's like, oh, this could happen, as if it's kind of analysis, but it's clearly more like a prescriptive manual for what they tried to make happen. But I also want to ask you, like, one of your characters is this Ghadri, right? Farid Ghadri. And I'd like you to talk about just that, like, follow, like, can we follow that thread a little bit? Like, can you talk about him and the Syria Reform Party and the CIA memo and the various things with that particular
character? So everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile that was the favorite of the Bush administration. And they thought when they invaded, they could go ahead and, you know, install him in power and he would be their puppet. So he was a favorite of Richard Perle and the neoconservatives.
This war is one of the most important acts that have happened in the entire history of the Middle East. This war is about democracy and human rights and freedom. Americans, as we move along in history, will be proud that their soldiers went to Iraq and overthrew one of the most brutal dictatorships in history and liberated this nation of 25 million.
Notwithstanding all that it's cost us beyond that and our reputation and everything else that's happened to the United States because of this war.
All of this will be clarified once we win, because the future of democracy in Iraq will be a beacon for the entire Arab and Muslim world. Now, it's difficult to see that now, but the dangerous thing to view is to fall into pessimism. pessimism of America, of the American people, about the future, about the ability to win this war, is the most dangerous sentiment that surrounds us. We have to be optimistic. And the American people, we have to perform.
Understand why they're pessimistic.
I can understand that, but it is our duty, our job, to do better work in Iraq, to perform better so that we can show results. We can show positive results of positive movement towards a stable Iraq and towards winning against the terrorists and against those people. Once we do that, we will infuse optimism and enthusiasm in America, and the American people are, if they see a good cause, if they see a noble cause, they are ready to support it. They are ready to move forward and support it, and they are ready to sacrifice for it.
And there was a Syrian equivalent of Chalabi, which was Farid Khadri, who started the Syria Reform Party. But, you know, he was a guy that mostly had lived in the United States for a long time, and the neoconservatives, in particular Richard Perle, just wanted to use him to kind of do what they wanted to do with Chalabi. And so Khadri, he detailed, you know, again, the plan. I guess I would say it's the CIA's cookbook. Because Syria had these sectarian divisions, you've got Christians, Druze, Sunni, Shia, Alawi, everything. Everybody understood and has understood for decades that the way to destroy Syria with a strong centralized Ba'athist government that could resist the Israeli and American projects in the region and that could support the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, Hezbollah, etc., the way to destroy the country is to create a sectarian war and divide the country up into ethnic cantons. And so that's what this guy, Khadri, was openly talking about doing is, hey, we've got to get protests started. And then if you can get protesters out into the streets and get the Syrian army to overreact and kill some people, then it can snowball and the Sunnis will start being angry at the Alawis and vice versa. And then before you know it, the country falls apart and, you know, the Israelis and the Americans are celebrating. Again, he was the Professor Joshua Landis, the Syria expert, you know, mentioned that Khadri, his ideas of what should happen in Syria basically took the neoconservative dream of creative chaos, creating chaos in the Middle East to its logical conclusion. And so that's what people need to understand. Again, we always think, oh, demonstrations, they must be a good thing. Well, sometimes they are, but in the American context, for example, what if a bunch of white supremacist Nazis were protesting against Obama? Well, I hate President Obama. I hate his guts, but I also wouldn't want to see a bunch of Nazi protesters with weapons taking over the United States. I don't know if that would be any better. So you just have to understand that the protests were one element of not bringing democracy to Syria, especially from the perspective of U.S. planners, but rather it was a way to create sectarian hatred and conflict that could lead to the breakup of the country and a potential U.S. military intervention. These different social media tools like Facebook actually exacerbated that. You know, rather than Facebook being a tool to bring democracy to a country, it's basically a way to spread rumors. It's how the algorithms work. The more divisive and hate-filled the posts are, the more they get spread around, and they're just a way to really create, in the case of Syria, you know, the ethnic hatred and ethnic violence that the U.S. was hoping to see.
I think there's a sort of, and I think your two articles kind of do that, is that on the one hand, there's the actual dirty business of war and regime change, because this is a regime change operation. This was not, I don't feel comfortable calling it a civil war. I find it too easy. I find that the term civil war has been so abused and occludes so much, you know, that this was a dirty war. This was a regional war, a proxy war that drew in all kinds of actors and also involved all these different nationalities, right? Famously, there are 80 different nationalities fighting for the supposed Syrian rebels. This story of the Syria war, I think, in some ways provides a kind of key to understanding the American regime change politics or project. of at least this phase of it of the last 20 years, the sort of Anglo-UK project that was, let's say, kicked off the famous memo that General Wesley Clark exposed, the was it 5 countries in 7 years? Or I always think, is it 7 countries in 5 years? 5 countries in 7 years. It's 5 and 7.
I think 7 countries in 5 years.
I was wrong. Okay, there we go.
It's worse than you think, right?
It's worse than I think.
And right after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." I said, "Is it classified?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Well, don't show it to me."
So like there's that famous line of like, this was the neocon goal. They didn't have any bones admitting it. I was actually turned on to the clean break paper, policy white paper that you cite in your piece by a prof in undergrad. And I remember reading it, and it was written in the 90s sometime, right? Where there are these actors, these nefarious actors, like, you know, they're, you know, these like these bookish men who, you know, live in the US and have these like mediocre jobs where nobody reads them. You know, they write these articles that are then used as the sort of intellectual basis to wage these insane billion-dollar projects. And it's like the goal of the entire neocon project, it ultimately failed, I think. I think it failed. I think it's safe to say that it failed from this distance, speaking in 2022, that the neocon dreams for the region that were cooked up two and a half decades ago by the worst of the worst people in U.S. foreign policy, which are now basically common doctrine, right? Like they won ideologically, but they lost militarily. And I think that ultimately that's a useful way to think about the phase, the project of Syria, which is on the one hand, there was this dirty war. On the other hand, there was this kind of very elaborate and extremely well-funded and extremely large media operation, and I call it a kind of pantomime, where the dirtiness of this war was whitewashed using all kinds of rhetorical devices. In the Kurdish realm, it was sold as Kurdish liberation via feminist anarchist revolution, and that had its own mini project involving intellectuals, military people, and its own thing, right? Like famously, David Graeber, the everybody's beloved favorite anarchist professor, was proud to announce that he's smuggling in drones into northeast Syria, I think at that time. No, through Turkey, of course. It was through Turkey, northwest, right? So, like, this is a man participating in a dirty war, in a dirty regime change war that was sold as liberation, but the ultimate goal was shared, right? Like neocons and anarchists shared a goal in Rojava, which was to, and I hate this term, and I try not to use it, and I'm actually not going to use it. I'm not going to use the term Balkanize, but to break up. Because the Balkans are a beautiful place, wonderful people. We shouldn't do this thing. It's orientalist as fuck. And so I'm going to stop using the verb Balkanize. Everyone follow my lead. But like the goal ultimately was the same, which was break up this country that provides the backbone to what has become known as the resistance axis, right? We know the role Syria has played both historically and in the contemporary time between forming a kind of backbone between Iran, Syria and Hezbollah in Lebanon, right? And an axis that is now extends to Yemen too, which of course is the reason why the Yemenis are fighting a dirty war. Well, the Yemenis are fighting a war too, which was also sold as a civil war. We're noticing patterns here, right? So, like, I feel that if you want to understand the last 20 years of our lives, and we're all around the same age, right? So we were all forged by these events politically. I think they all affected us in different ways, radicalizing us and whatever. And me, I mean, I talk about me. I actually was radicalized, and then I de-radicalized myself. And then I came back to this podcast and started it and radicalized myself again. So, like, but part of it was, and part of that secondary radicalization phase was looking at Syria, was looking at what happened in Libya, and how Libya was a kind of blueprint for what could have happened in Syria. But the difference between Syria and Libya, obviously, was a question of allies, right? Gaddafi and Libya had no allies to come and support them, whereas Syria did. Syria had very powerful allies. So that's kind of my general estimate of this entire crazy thing. And I think in some ways, your work has really sort of cemented and sort of filled in a lot of the question marks I have now. Like you, I just heard protests, demonstrators, shooting, bad. And I would just, you know, and I just went along with it. This thing in Syria, though, has been unfolding for over a decade now. And the war part of it has more or less, I mean, it's not ended. The country is still in a state of war. But the hotness of that war has definitely gone down. The temperature of that war has definitely gone down drastically. And a strange kind of equilibrium or balance, I guess we could say, has been enacted between these three zones, which is the Northwest is currently occupied by these Turkish aligned factions where they've all consolidated. These jihadis have all consolidated under the rubric of Turkish affiliated factions or whatever. And then you have this breakaway section. Then you have the main part of the country, this sort of central region, which is controlled by the government and the Syrian Arab Army, which is a multinational force. And I guess there's the NDF, but the NDF is a different story. But and then you have the Northeast, right, where a large part of the country has been cut off from the part of control by the government under the control of the Kurds, the Kurdish faction, PKK, which was rebranded under the auspices of the U.S. military. The U.S. military named the Syrian Democratic Forces. Let's just say that again out loud. That the Syrian Democratic Forces were named by a U.S. general. That should tell you the state of things in Syria. That, like, who is the source? I mean, I have done episodes with a Kurdish person who was there, and he sort of, you know, he's sort of critical of it, and he kind of sees through it now, and people can go and consult that episode. It's from last year. It's around this time, actually, last year. But I think this long question that I want to ask, which is, the goal was to break the Syrian government and to break the Syrian state. That goal has failed. How do we assess the largest success of that failure? Does that make sense? Like, what goals did they achieve inside of that failure? Which is to say, like, they destroyed the country, weakened an important element of this resistance axis, killed a lot of people through this violence, and stole a lot of resources from the Syrian state and starved it by taking out those resources via the oil in the northeast. So the long way of saying is that, like, you know, militarily they may have lost, but ideologically, they're especially in our part of the world, you know, the Syrian government is this pariah government, dictator. I mean, just yesterday, all this pontificating by people about publishing op-eds and stuff. Like, there is a media blockade discursively on Syria, and if you question it, you'll lose a lot of credibility. I think, you know, anyways, this is me asking you, like, what this playbook that they have, they achieved a lot. Even if their goal, they lost the war, they still won a lot of battles. And part of that was destroying huge swaths of the country and weakening them, killing a lot of the military. But isn't there an ironic thing, though, inside of that? This is me asking a question inside of my other question, which is, they've strengthened the popularity of the government in the sense that, like, this government stuck around. This government under the president, and it's easy to sort of cheapen Syria and simplify it to this one guy, you know, which is what the reactionaries do, which is what, like, rebels and their supporters want you to do, and sort of essentialize it into this one man and make it all about him and his personal failure and his his own dictatorial status. And instead, what we're talking about in reality is dislodging a state that's existed for 50 years. And this is kind of an earlier question that I began to ask and then got distracted. But that wasn't it kind of impossible, this task they were asking, that like that the project itself was bound to fail because of the nature of the actors involved, that they couldn't have sustained, you know, the scale of this war with all of its participants? Like did the CIA bite off more than it could chew?
Well, it's definitely a difficult task because, you know, whatever you think of Bashar al-Assad, it's just obvious he was extremely popular. Based on what I can tell, Syrians kind of had mixed feelings about the government for the most part. They seemed to love Bashar, but also they wanted reforms, and a lot of people complained about like the local security, intelligence services, corruption, different things like that. So Syrians had complaints about the government, but they genuinely, as far as I could, everything I can find suggests that Assad was extremely popular. And the main thing is people did not want the country to break apart and turn into what Iraq had turned into next door. So in, you know, 2006, 2007 in Iraq, as we know, there was a sectarian war. I had a really good Iraqi refugee friend. She's a Shia, her husband's Sunni, and some Jaish al-Mahdi guys that literally lived like down the street came over, invaded their house, kidnapped him, tortured him, and then told, when they eventually released him, they killed his brother, but they eventually released him and they said, hey, get out of here. If you don't leave by tomorrow, we're going to kill you. So of course they went, and where did they go? They went to Damascus, and they found safety in Damascus. But in Iraq, there was that type of sectarian war where, you know, if you had a Shia name, you might go to a checkpoint and there are some Sunni militants that would kill you if your name was Ali or something. And then on the other hand, if you went to a checkpoint from the police, the special forces from the Ministry of Interior, and you had a Sunni name like Omar, they would kill you for that. So if the CIA wanted, and they did want to unleash a sectarian war of that exact sort in Syria, like what happened in Iraq, if that was their goal, they did fail. Like that never happened in Syria. Like you're saying, is it a civil war? Is it a proxy war? Is it a dirty war? It never got to the point like it did in Iraq, where literally neighbors were murdering each other because of their sect. The Syrian army stayed together. Most of the Syrian army is Sunni. And so it never took on that character like it did in Iraq, and the central government stayed in place. Bashar al-Assad and the government is still there. They did hold most of the country together. So the maximalist goal of regime change failed. And that was a big part of, you know, the reason for, say, doing the false flag chemical attack in Damascus in Eastern Ghouta in 2013 was to elicit a U.S. intervention. And obviously, Barack Obama was, you know, inches away from actually authorizing the intervention that the certain factions in the U.S. government wanted, that the Turkish government wanted, that the opposition obviously wanted. And he ended up backing off of it. So that maximalist goal of regime change failed. But on the other end, and inducing a full-on sectarian war did fail. Again, in Aleppo, people support the government, and most of the people in Aleppo are Sunni. But on the other hand, if you go back to like even further back than the clean break to the Oded Yanan plan that I referenced in the paper as well, where the Israeli goal for both Iraq and Syria ever since the 80s was to begin to break up these strong centralized Ba'athist governments that could give the Israelis trouble and to break them up into just ethnic cantons or weak, tiny, mini ethnic states, which David Wormser and Richard Perle and the other neocons, you know, also wanted to do, even though that initial idea was articulated back in the 80s. If we think that was the goal of U.S. planners, then that actually succeeded. Because like you mentioned, Idlib is controlled by al-Qaeda and the Turks and the Turkish army. And then the U.S. and the SDF, they control eastern Syria with all the grain and the water and the oil. And the country has largely broken up into these different pieces. And so even though the central government did manage to win and survive the U.S.-backed dirty war, the country still is divided. It's under sanctions. It's weak. The Israelis seem to bomb Damascus every other week or two, and the Syrian government can't do much about it. So in that sense, I feel like the U.S. has really won the war, even though they never actually fully got the regime change that they, you know, that they probably would have preferred. But in the end, because they've broken up the country and kept it weak, the U.S. and Israelis are probably totally happy with the outcome.
There's another element to this that I really appreciate your articles for, because you kind of start off by talking about Rabin Yassin Kassab, and that was like the first book that I, you know, when I wanted to understand what the Assad must go perspective was, I read that book cover to cover and found it unconvincing, let's just say. But like a lot of the stories that they tell about, you know, the graffiti kids and the initial kind of assassinations and the government just shooting protesters, these are all like kind of factual debates that you sort of present the state of knowledge about these, like whatever we know and whatever we can't definitively say, you sort of give us in these articles. And I think that's really important, because, you know, a lot of these things, like if it was all true, like if I believed everything that they said, I would probably support the overthrow of us. I don't know. I mean, you'd have to still look at the consequences, and the consequences would still be horrific. But like, if everything they said was true, you know, their case would be a stronger case. But like, when you look at it in the level of detail, can you talk about the graffiti kid story and also the shootings? I guess these are different sections in different articles, but
yeah. Well, to start off, again, according to the usual narrative, there were these young boys in Dera, the small town near the Jordanian border in southern Syria, that supposedly in a spontaneous act of rebellion against a dictator wrote graffiti on the school wall that said, "It's your turn, doctor," referring to Assad, who was, you know, an ophthalmologist, or trained as an ophthalmologist in England before coming back to Syria and taking power once his father died. But those boys were supposedly tortured, their fingernails pulled out, and other terrible things done to them, and detained for several weeks by the political security chief Atif Najib in Dera, and that then made locals so angry that it sparked the protests on March 18th, 2011. And then in response to that first protest on that Friday, outside the Omari Mosque, Syrian security forces supposedly just immediately opened fire and killed four protesters. And, you know, things basically, you know, went from there. Again, it's the classic cartoonish dictator massacring peaceful protesters. But if you take a closer look at events,
children, right? Like, I mean, torturing children. Yep. And then the story that was in the book, which you also talk about, is like a delegation went to the police station to demand the children back, and they said, if you want your children back, you're gonna have to make more of them, or something like, some really
basically said, if, you know, forget about your children, if you want more, we'll make more for you. In other words, we'll like rape your women and get them pregnant again. Mm-hmm. So that's the narrative about how the Syria war started. And you're right. If all of the things were true that are said about the Syrian government, yeah, I don't know. I it makes sense that you would hate Assad and hate the Syrian government. If that turned out to really all be true. Not only that, but all the different things like the Hula massacre and the chemical attacks and and all the different things that are that people try to pin on the Syrian government that just turns out to be propaganda. But it would make sense to be as opposed to the government as many of these people are. And, you know, but it's just not true. And that's the tough thing about the Syria war. And that's why it took me, you know, 5 years to finally write something about the war. Cause for the first 5 years, I was like, oh, it makes sense to me. This, you know, fuck this guy. These, you know, but if you really look more closely, and it's tough because you need to, for me, at least, it took reading a lot of Arabic sources to figure out a lot of this stuff. And of course, not that many people can read Arabic. So,
what can you tell us what you're under, just like there's lots of stuff in these articles, but like, I feel like people will get a sense of what's in it. Just if you just tell us what you think now happened with the graffiti kids.
So yeah, sorry to get distracted there. So with those kids, what it turns out is that, like I said, there are all these U.S. funded activists that had been receiving U.S. funding for years. Some of them were secular. Others were Salafists, supporters of an exiled cleric named Muhammad Surur. And before these, February 2011, just as the Arab Spring protests were going on in Tunisia and Egypt, the activists in Syria needed some type of event to spark the same type of protests they hoped in Syria as, occurred in Egypt and in Tunisia. And so there was a campaign by activists to paint graffiti on the walls in different cities in Syria, not only in Deraa, but in Damascus and elsewhere. This was an organized political campaign to spray graffiti like the people want the fall of the regime. And again, it's your turn, doctor, to fall just like Mubarak. And so it turns out, and I detail this in my article, that the boys that actually graffitied on the walls of the school and that were detained, they didn't do that out of a spontaneous political protest against a hated dictator. They were actually manipulated into doing that by older teenagers who were activists. Some of those activists had been previous to that time had been attacking policemen in Deraa using Molotov cocktails. And some of those same boys were arrested for that. And some of these activists, again, they manipulated these young boys who didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what they were writing. They just wrote these slogans on the walls of the school because the older boys told them to. And so again, what that shows is that this was all manipulated and engineered, and they wanted the young boys to get detained. They wanted to create some type of event that would spark big protests, just like the deaths of Khalid Said and Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia and Egypt sparked big protests there. So all of this was manufactured. And then again, it's unclear to me how, if the boys, young boys, were actually tortured. It's possible they were. They reported that they were tortured, but not in the way that they was claimed. For example, being, you know, burned really badly or having their fingernails pulled out and things like that, or the idea that the security officials threatened to rape the mothers of the boys that came to request their being released. All those were acknowledged by pro-opposition people to be exaggerations.
Yeah, like you, specifically Azmi Bashara and Mark McKinnon, who's like a Globe and Mail reporter, and then Azmi Bashara, who's, you know, based in Qatar and was a big proponent of overthrowing Assad. So
yeah,
those were like two of your sources that you kind of weigh, you know, against the original claims.
Right? Well, Mark McKinnon did, report because he interviewed the boys years later. And he's the one that talked about how they got manipulated into writing the graffiti on the walls. But he does report that the boys were tortured, that they were, you know, put in tires and beaten very badly and things like this. But Rania Abu Zaid, who is a reporter pro-opposition but spent a ton of time in Syria and is actually a really good reporter, she wrote, you know, that the boys weren't kids, they were boys, they weren't children, and the claims of torture and things were exaggerated. And then Azmi Bashara wrote that the claims were exaggerated. So I don't know exactly, you know, what happened there. I can't say for sure if the kids were tortured or not. But what I can say for sure is that the idea that the boys of their own, you know, initiative wrote those slogans, that didn't happen. This was all engineered by pro-opposition activists that were trying to create some type of event that could spark big protests. And that those activists were in touch with, you know, with U.S.-funded activists, for example, Jacob Applebaum, who we can talk about. And then if you want, I could talk more about, you know, the actual first protest on March 18th, that Friday. I can get into that if you'd like, but...
I actually kind of don't want to, because I feel like your article does a great job and people should go for the article, because the characters, there's so many characters, they're so sprawling. And, you know, we've already been here at for like an hour, because I do want to sort of ask a bigger question, which is like, and it's kind of continuation from the previous point I was making, is that the degree of difficulty of what these imperialists and their allies, right? Because, you know, we actually haven't talked about the role of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf monarchies in all of this that much, and Turkey as well, and the sort of regional state actors who were participating in this thing, which was ultimately led by the US and UK, right? Because they're the top dogs, but ultimately, like, right, these required people in the region to participate too, right? Regional allies. This became a regional proxy war. And I think that, like, the temptation on our end, because none of us have ever lived in a society that has devolved into civil war, because we live in these like states that are very strong, right? That can resist a lot, right? Like, we saw millions of people hit the streets this last summer, right? And there was a lot of disturbances on the street. Like, if there was a lot of damage, like hundreds of millions of dollars of damage. I mean, there hasn't even really been that much accounting of what the George Floyd uprising, as it's coming to be called, sort of like cost the U.S. I mean, I haven't seen body counts, and, you know, like, that was conveniently erased. And yet the logic of, like, the regime change sort of mindset that's been inculcated into us over decades is that protest equals disruption mass protest equals downfall of the regime, right? And that became a whole thing. There are books and entire authors. I mean, really, we need to have a different conversation after this episode and, like, a subsequent one about the media aspect of us, is that the sort of framing and the drama and the sort of just sheer amount of publications that came out of this. But again, I go back to this thing, is that, like, the ironic result of all this is that you've made this guy more popular in the eyes of a lot of Syrians, because he was there, he stayed there. I mean, there was a point when they offered him his resignation. I remember that, right? Like, they offered the resignation and they didn't want it, right? They wanted to destroy the country. They wanted to break it up into the statelets, the weak statelets that can be easily controlled and dominated, which is an imperialist ploy, which is the same dream they have for China, which is the same dream they have for Russia. But Russia and China, they haven't gotten any far. Like, they almost got Russia to, like, get Dagestan and stuff. But that's a story that plays out here too, remember? Like, if Vladimir Putin doesn't experience what happens in Chechnya in the 90s and the 2000s, does he go along with Qasem Soleimani's proposal? Like, does he, like, the fact that they had these regime change wars earlier and they broke up Yugoslavia, right? I mean, Yugoslavia, that's the example, I guess, the site. It's like, that's the project. That's a success of these ghouls, right? That, like, this, the fact that they tried this on Russia and it didn't work and it backfired, and it actually brought to power this guy that they're still dealing with, right? Like, they're still dealing with this guy, Vladimir Putin, who's still a pain in the ass, who's still blocking their imperialist ambitions, like, where they go. And the fact that he chose to intervene, I mean, we can talk about Libya and the lack of intervention there, at least from the Russian side, and what the consequences of that was. But I don't know. We're talking about Syria today, and I haven't done enough justice in my own research to Libya. I don't know. I wasn't Libya-pilled the way I was, like, Syria-pilled. But, you know, again, I'm thinking out loud here, and I'm just asking this question. Like, this was an insane goal to dislodge the state, this powerful, large, you know, diverse, like, and secular state that had flourished, that has a lot of resources, but also geographically and politically posed a major threat to this neocon you know, new Middle East. And I remember, in 2013, like all the liberal journalists, I remember what's her name was passing around this tweet of Robin Wright, you know, the, you know, mediocre lib journalist who's like Iran specialist. They were just dreaming of these little statelets. Oh, Sunnis go here and Shias go here. Like, it's like a spice rack. Didn't you know? Like, this region with hundreds of millions of people is just a spice rack where you put in the ethnicities according to your own organizational pattern. You know, I mean, and this is the insanity of that regime change project. Now, did they achieve their goals? No. Did they achieve destruction of the country? Yes. Did they kill a lot of people? Yes. Did they get rid of this pain in the ass guy? No. Did they, in fact, help elevate the position of Iran, their enemy, in the region? Yes. Right? Not just through Syria, but also through Iraq. Right? And that's why they killed Qasem Soleimani, was to score a cheap victory over a guy who had been instrumental in their defeat.
I gotta go pretty soon, but I wanna... I do find it really interesting that William, you said early on that you kind of believe that the U.S. did win, and Sina believes so strongly that the U.S. didn't win. And I, you know, you guys agree on, I think we all agree on what happened. So, you know, like in terms of the facts of, you know, who has what and where everybody is right now on the map. But you know, I guess I'd like to go back to William and just ask you that, like, how do you respond to Sina's like insistence that the, you know, that this was a big defeat, for the U.S. Cause you know, this is something that I go back and forth on as well. And Sina, you guys should feel free to continue, but I gotta go in about 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, again, I guess it just depends on, you know, how you define winning. And you're right. I mean, in many ways, the partnership between Iran, Russia, and Syria is much stronger now. And the Russian intervention in 2015 was so important. I mean, ISIS was knocking on the doors of Damascus, not only in Yarmouk camp in the southern suburbs, but also coming from the east, from the direction of Palmyra, and Nusra was coming from the north, from Idlib. And it looked like the black flags were going to be flying over Damascus, and the Russians intervened and turned the tide. And that's when the U.S. realized that the Syrian and the Russian armies were going to defeat the jihadists. And that's when the U.S. abandoned ISIS as a proxy and pivoted to, like you mentioned before, Sina, establishing the you know, turning the YPG into the Syrian Democratic Forces, and then using the SDF as their proxy instead, and it basically sparked this race to Raqqa, where the Syrian and Russian armies were coming to defeat the Islamic State from the south and the west, and then the Kurds and the Americans were coming from the north and the east. And your podcast with Christopher Halali, I think, was totally fascinating. And like you mentioned, the anarchists just, you know, bought into that, where they were just fighting literally alongside, you know, the U.S. forces. But again, whether the U.S. won or not, it just depends on how you define it. And I'm leaning towards, again, saying that the U.S. has won, because if you look at the position or how things are now compared to, say, 2010, again, all of northeastern Syria is under U.S. occupation, partly directly and via their Kurdish allies and the SDF. And Idlib, as we talked about, is under Turkish and Al-Qaeda control. And the Israelis can just, you know, bomb Damascus at will. And it just seems like in many ways, the situation, the Syrian state is weaker and the situation is worse for, you know, the resistance than it was in 2010. But, you know, the story is not over yet. You know, it may not be, I know a lot of people suggest that it's not possible for the U.S. to really maintain their presence in the Northeast and to keep the Kurds as their proxies indefinitely. And obviously here and there, the Kurds make, you know, talk with the central government about possibly, you know, reconciling and coming back. But so I don't know if the current situation will hold, or if at some point the Syrian army can retake Idlib and or retake, you know, the northeast. So I guess it's kind of yet to be determined, but unfortunately, I guess I'm on the pessimistic side, and I kind of feel like at this point, at least if things don't change, then maybe for now, the U.S. and the Israelis, so far at least, have won, you know.
A stalemate positive to them, or definitely relative to pre-2011.
Yeah, I mean, just going back to that Yanan plan from the 80s, that's what the Israelis wanted. They wanted an Alawite rump state in Latakia in the mountains. They wanted... They just want the country divided, you know, and that's kind of the situation we're in, unfortunately.
But listen, I do have one question. If we're going to end it here for William, what are you working on now? What are you going to what's your next Syria research project?
Well, I'm working on a book. Scott at the Libertarian Institute said he'd publish a book if I can finish it. So I'm working on that. I also am working on an article. Again, because of that time when I was in Sinjar, you know, I've kept an eye on what happened there pretty closely. And I'm pretty sure that the U.S. deliberately allowed or wanted ISIS to take over Mosul and also to take over Sinjar as part of the broader effort to foster ISIS as a proxy that could take out the Syrian government. So I'd like to... I'm working on an article to kind of flesh that out and kind of show the U.S. role in or U.S. responsibility for the genocide of the Yazidis. But that and just, yeah, writing an entire book. So I like you said, Sina, if you ever do a podcast only on Syria, I hope you let me participate even just to sit in on the conversations, because it's such a nice thing to have a podcast. It gives you the chance to talk to a lot of interesting people, and even if I could sit in the background, that would be great. But there's so much. I mean, I got to write an article about I've got a lot of material on the 2013 gas attack that I need to finish, about, you know, U.S. supplying TOW missiles to Al-Qaeda to take over Idlib in 2015. Some more stuff on the Hula. I've got some stuff on the Hula massacre. I don't know. There's just so much. I mean, again, this war, there's so many aspects to it, and you can... to know really well what happened in every part of Syria, like what happened in Raqqa, what happened in Halab, what happened in all these different places. There's just so many aspects to it. It just kind of seems like it never ends. But anyways, I guess that's a bit of an idea. Thank you.